for LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson. And I'm joined here today by David Chang. David, I'm going to run through some credits here quickly. So you have the Momofuku Restaurants, your new majordomo here in Los Angeles, Majordomo Media, which includes the Dave Chang Show podcast, formerly had the magazine Lucky Peach, and then we're here to talk specifically about your Netflix series Ugly Delicious. And so that just leads me to my first question, which is simply, how do you see yourself? How does all that stuff connect for you?
Somehow it connects. I'm not sure exactly. I know somewhere in the ether there's an overlap of all those things. But I think it's really just an extension of just trying to do something interesting, creative, and a way of sort of just making something good, whether it's content or food. And one of the reasons why I'm able to do this is we have a great team across the board. What I do is not a singular effort. Momofuku and the whole team involved in Majordomo Media, it's all talented people that allow this to happen.
And now, tell me a little bit about the impulse behind Ugly Delicious. It's not a cooking show or a restaurant show. In so many ways, it's really about what food means, sort of culturally, politically. Like, what was the impulse behind creating the show in the way that it is?
Well, I think it was about trying to tell stories that we felt weren't being told. I think there's a consistent theme, whether it's the restaurants we open up or the stories we're trying to tell in TV. We just oftentimes need a good partner. And I met Morgan through mutual friends. And as we started to hang out, he was like, hey, like, maybe there's something here for me to help you guys explain and to narrate and to put together. And I thought that was just sort of the missing link, getting someone of his caliber and the whole Tremolo team to tell stories in a different way. And not that they're not been told, but I think the difference was telling stories in a mainstream way and using food as a vehicle to talk about different things. Because food right now, more than ever, I believe, because of social media and technology and communications is at this like threshold of importance, right? In culture, it's like food is culture essentially. So there's a way to talk about it that maybe someone might not have heard before.
And was it difficult for you to kind of come up with the topics, the locations, the restaurants, the guests? I know for myself, watching some of the episodes, especially like say, for example, the fried chicken episode, I did not expect that to become as sort of emotional and deep of an exploration of cultural appropriation as that episode is. And how did you make those connections between fried chicken and these bigger cultural ideas?
I want to try it again.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to eat your food without like eating like a lunatic.
You want me to get you a knife and a fork and just let you slice off of it a little bit at a time? Or are you going to go for it the way we eat it?
I want you to teach me how to eat it.
Okay.
Well, a lot of the topics, fried chicken being one of them, there were a lot of topics because you could choose anything, right? Anything, like bottled water, yogurt, whatever, and you could go down a rabbit hole and really unpack quite a bit. And fried chicken, we knew from the get-go was going to be something we wanted to tackle, but we weren't quite sure how because it is such a loaded, it's a food that a lot of people don't know that much about, even though a lot of people eat it. And I think early on, I knew there were moments, at least how I could relate to a food like fried chicken, because of moments, right? The Fuzzy Zeller moment in Augusta, not the Masters moment where he tells Tiger Woods to not serve fried chicken, right? When I did the Late Show, Jimmy Fallon, and now Questlove was like, hey, you can talk about this. Like, I was so cautious about how to approach these topics that, like, I didn't want to speak on anyone's behalf. And when I was doing the fried chicken episode, Questlove was like, hey, like, you're not going to see me eating fried chicken. And I was like, why? I mean, like, why not? And he's like, because. And I remember that moment being like, I want to know more, but I don't want to poke and prod and ask because I feel like I should know already. And then when I did some more homework on my own, it dawned on me like, oh, many people don't know. So we just needed a forum to be able to talk about these things. And I think it's about preserving stories, lost stories oftentimes that are not getting the recognition that they deserve. And fried chicken was a very difficult subject for all of us involved. Jason Zeldis actually directed it, that episode, and I'm really proud of what we did. I think there's a lot more to be discussed, but I wanted to make sure that we were part of that conversation.
But were you surprised that you could go as deep as you did, and it was as emotional both for you and for the subjects as it became?
Yeah, it's not just with fried chicken. It's anything now when I feel like I'm inquiring or even attempting to speak on behalf of anyone else, there's a sense of, I wouldn't say duty, but I think responsibility of like, wait, I guess this must what must feel like to be a journalist, because I don't consider myself one, of like, you got to tell the truth, or at least try to find new perspectives to tell that truth. And it really surprised me at how uncomfortable everyone was to talk about it. That was really surprising. And in reflection, knowing it, right? Part of it is because, like, I've never had these discussions before, and that was really tough.
But is there sort of an essential emotional connection that we just as people have to food that makes it sort of the conduit for those conversations? I'm thinking especially, like, say, in the home cooking episode where you're with your own family and you're talking about kind of the meaning of food. And you talk throughout the series about yourself as a child, the way other people would treat you and right. your family because of the food that you ate. And so those sort of connections, was it important to you to sort of like have the show tackle those kind of things?
The women in my life express love through food. My grandmother was an amazing cook. My mother is an amazing cook.
Mama.
Mama. Love was shown as, have you had enough to eat? Till this day, when I talk to my mom, just the first thing she says is, what have you eaten? Have you had enough to eat? The first thing I remember my grandmother making me all the time were these roasted potatoes with sugar. And she learned how to make this like Russian soup with ketchup in it, which was very weird. And when I associate food and love, that's the kind of food that makes me happy. And I think that maybe one reason why I'm shying away from maybe more of the Eurocentric style of food is that I associate a lot of terrible memories with that. Working in a kitchen, that's hard. Like, I associate better things with stuff that I think my mom and my grandmother made. Yeah, I mean, in general, I tend to work out thorny issues about myself and just anything I do, and how I represent food or how I interact with food has changed throughout my life. Obviously, in the home cooking episode, as I've gotten older, I'm much more comfortable in realizing that I can't change my skin color and that I should not necessarily even be proud, but I should accept where I came from, where my parents came from. And, you know, it's interesting because food is really something that is so simple and everyone takes for granted, but it contains all the stories of the past. Everyone needs to eat, and everyone would really rather eat well. And how something became delicious is packed with so many perspectives and so many stories. And it's so potentially like groundbreaking and like Pandora's box sometimes. I think people just want to keep that lid shut.
I was so struck throughout the show, your attitude towards, for lack of a better way to put it, authenticity. Oftentimes people, they seem to want to like keep everybody stay in their lane, keep these things in this traditional way. And you always seem to like mixing things up, doing things in like an unusual or unexpected way. I found that surprising.
Hmm.
And what for you, what is it that you like about sort of those juxtapositions or those sort of collisions on a plate of food?
Well, in terms of authenticity, somehow I feel like I've found my voice or comfort by not accepting anything. I'm the kid that was never supposed to be the class clown or the person that was rebelling against stuff, but I think I've been doing that my entire life. And it's not necessarily that I hate authenticity. I think there are really good pockets of specific kinds of authenticity, like preserving narratives or anything where it's about making sure that you're educating how something happened, I think is great. But that can be problematic when that becomes the only narrative. And I don't think that authenticity, particularly in food, and you can use food to talk about a lot of things in culture, food is something where if you look at everything has been bastardized, everything has come from somewhere else. And let's just say like French food. French food isn't really like France. It's Italian food really isn't just Italian food. Chinese food came from everywhere, even American food. I would say like majority of the food that we consider American is all from Africa. So it's like, wait a second, why should we take for granted how that happened? And it's just the evolution of human culture. It's just like there's going to be collisions of stuff. And if you understand that, I think you can be really respectful simultaneously. So I guess at the core of it too, I just dislike when multitude of viewpoints are not being embraced.
Well, I think it becomes almost like a running gag throughout the series that you're constantly comparing dishes to something from Asian food.
Right.
And
a lot of it is not necessarily a joke, but it's almost like a thesis, just mm-hmm. a test. As like, okay, why not, right? Sort of that was developed, I remember thinking in college, like where it's like one of my professors, like everything basically created in antiquity was from Asia, from China. And once you start to look at that, what if, right? Because like so many of our narratives are not necessarily true. They're written by the winners or they're lost histories. So you don't know. And I imagine like, even if I'm completely wrong, right? I joke, for instance, what if tomato sauce was actually invented by the Chinese in terms of like Italian pasta? That is a more interesting narrative to me than just like however it might have happened. And if you can sort of use sort of rational paranoia, you can almost imagine how that could have happened as well, right? The spice route and going through like, you know, through Burma. And I'm not going to talk about this crazy theory that I have, but like the idea that using your imagination, when you can blend together how cultural histories might have happened, is really exciting. For instance, if my parents moved, or let's just say my grandparents moved to Charleston, South Carolina, 150 years ago, would they use grits? Would they use smoky bacon? Would they use bourbon instead of Korean soju? Yes, of course they would. And you could see like maybe instead of using mung beans for bindaedok, they're going to start to use the corn. And that's just, you use what's around you. And part of that was just inspired by travel. When I go to Sao Paulo, I've been to Sao Paulo a couple times in my life, and the oldest center of town is the Koreatowns and the Chinatowns, and they're like 200 years old. And you're going to places where they only speak Portuguese, and they're run by like Chinese or Korean shop owners, and they're making food that looks Brazilian, but it's Korean or it's Chinese. And you're like, of course, if someone's been here for 100 plus years, it's going to be something else. So it's not crazy to me to almost like make some sort of fake algorithm in my head about how something might turn out to be, right?
Do you feel like that thesis, is that also borne out when someone goes to eat a majordomo? Like, is the sort of thesis that you present with the show, do you feel like you're also sort of putting that in action in your menus?
Yeah, I think majordomo is probably the best realization of anything I've ever done. May not be the best work I've ever done. I don't know, but I've never felt a sense of confidence in terms of what we're doing. Again, not everything is going to be sensible to someone else. I know that it's hard for people that might be coming from the San Gabriel Valley. And the Korean food, it's a lot more Korean, but we're intentionally not making it like certain dishes you can get in Koreatown because I don't want us to compare to what they're doing. I want those restaurants to continue to be successful. And I want to almost make a dish that pays homage to that, but create a new way of just basically saying, hey, like, this is really delicious food. You don't even have to think about it. Don't even think about the cultural aspects of food. It's just food. And if it's delicious to you, great. But if you want to go down this rabbit hole in this dish, it's there. That's what I wanted Majordomo to be for me. And I thought it's because it's LA. It's a place that I've long admired. I wanted to make it very special. I don't think of any other place in America right now that can blend together so many things. It's like the place that I should have been in years ago.
Why do you think that is? What? Because you're not the first successful chef to come to Los Angeles from. What is the appeal of Los Angeles to a chef like yourself?
This is going to be, I could sound like a real jackass sound, like using the artist comparison, and I'm not. I'm actually using one of the films that Morgan Neville did about LA artists and how in the 40s to 60s, like there was a renaissance of, not even renaissance, just a surgence of new kinds of art being made in LA. And I think it was because they were not beholden to the East Coast sensibilities or Europe for that matter. They were like, we can do whatever we want because no one cares. That was sort of the same vibe I get in LA. It's like, we can do whatever we want because like we're not New York. We have great produce. Like that's the thing I think that I don't know if a lot of people from New York understands. People in LA, specifically to food, have said, we've had great food for the past 50 years. It's only now you guys are beginning to learn that, like, we've got great Mexican food. We've got great Korean food. We've got Wolfgang Puck. We've got Suzanne Goyen. We've got probably the best Chinese food, arguably, in North America. So, and all these other different pockets, right? So I think if you're a Los Angelino, you're like, screw off. Like, we don't need you guys' approval, right? So that's what's interesting. I think it's developed in this bubble. And people in Los Angeles, to me, have never needed the accolades or the approval of anyone else. And it's something that I've watched from afar and I've long admired. And I think part of it is because it seems like it's a fresh start to me.
And now to get back to talking about the show, you have these juxtapositions even between, pardon the phrase, like sort of high and low with the restaurants that you're even sort of exploring. I mean, I think that like in the taco episode, you get into Taco Bell or in the pizza episode, you get into Domino's, things that people might not assume you as a fancy food person would be interested in talking about or exploring. How do you kind of see those distinctions, and what made you want to kind of explore that in the show?
Well, I guess this is runs parallel to the concept of authenticity. I also believe that the tyranny of being right, can be problematic, that only certain kinds of pizza can be acceptable, right? And I like things that are happen to be lowbrow, and I know that it irks. Sometimes I like lowbrow things just to bother the food police, but Domino's is one of those things where people are like, hey, do they sponsor you? I'm like, no. If they do down the road, great, but probably it'll never happen. But the simple fact is my first childhood pizza was Domino's. I grew up in Northern Virginia. Where am I going to get authentic pizza anywhere? And it was something that my brothers would get every Sunday. That's the thing I would look forward to watch NFL football and get Domino's pizza. That was like my childhood. Do I order it? Probably 3-4 times a year, but it's eating nostalgia for me. It's not the best pizza in the world, right? I don't think so, but like, here's the deal. I've had the best pizza all over the world, but I'm not going to tell someone that never left their hometown and they love Domino's that if they like Domino's, they have a terrible palate. You know what I mean? Like, that to me is stupid. And if someone enjoys something, the worst thing we can say is like, you're wrong. It's like, it's just one opinion. And part of liking Domino's or other things that you're not supposed to like, if you like super high-end stuff, I think that's sensible. It's being pragmatic, right? And I think that for me, after, you know, several months of thinking about the show and since it's been launched, is that in some ways, I think Ugly Delicious Now has been some kind of goal of like culinary pragmatism or some kind of American pragmatism that like, let's celebrate the things that are useful, right? And that's it, right? To say something's not good because it's not useful, I can understand that. But if someone likes something, the worst thing you can say is, like, you're wrong.
Right, because another one of my favorite things on the series is simply when, like, when you're talking about something or when you're in one location and somehow someone says, like, Tokyo, and then suddenly the show just cuts and, like, goes to Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's similar in a way to the way that you put together your magazine Lucky Peach, in that there's a freedom to the show. Like, there's no set opening credits. Like, the opening credits are different every episode. And to be perfectly honest, I've reflected on this for myself and my own work, in that your show is always the thing that it needs to be. You and Morgan and putting it together allowed the show to kind of be the thing it always needed
to
be. And
I've gotten way too much credit on the show, first of all. Like, you know, it's Morgan, it's Eddie Schmidt, Peter Meehan helped out a bunch. Like, we have so many people. I've been getting way too much credit, first of all. You know, I don't direct. I don't edit. Like, there's a lot of work that went involved. I just got to eat a lot of good food and go around. But in terms of the narrative, though, every episode's different, and it can be confusing at times. I'm sure of it, but that's intentionally so. But we do, I mean, I know that there was a lot of work to make it seem that if you watch it a couple times, you're going to see that there is a theme and there's a structure that sort of ties it all together.
Again, just the idea of the kind of emotions of food and like what they bring up. Is that something, I mean, I think the classic example now is the movie Ratatouille and the critic in Ratatouille. Like, is that something that you think about either when you were putting together the show, but also in your cooking, is just like, how does this make you feel? How do you think it's going to make audiences, you know, your customers feel?
Yeah.
Where do the emotions of this fit in?
Of the show itself?
Yeah.
It was terrifying. I wasn't really thinking about how it was going to be interpreted by an audience, because I've never really done this before. We just wanted to make good TV. That was it. I think the goal, I remember it was, number one, has to be educational. Number two, it has to promote the culinary arts at large. And three, it should selfishly give me ideas for R&D. Right. And that was it. Right. I didn't really think too much about how someone might internalize it. That was really anxiety ridden. February 23rd at launch. And that was really, really tough week.
Are there things that you're doing in your cooking now or that are on some of your recent menus that you feel like came out of the process of making the show?
Yeah, I've been working on that barbecue idea for a while with Adam Perry Lang. Some of the dishes, I won't even say yes. I think these are things that have been percolating in my mind for a long time. I think that the one thing that I've taken from the show that is somehow manifesting itself in the food is how a lot of these conversations that we've had are still lingering, right? Like, if you go to one of our restaurants in DC, you're going to see the crawfish there, right? But like, there was a lot there in the sense that how I look at food now, I'm trying to look at it from a perspective that gives me as many viewpoints as possible. Like, let's just say in the fried chicken episode, David Simon basically smacks me down because I was talking crap about kimchi. Because the night before, we were at a very traditional New Orleans restaurant, and we got a flight of kimchi for $18. And I was so upset. We filmed the next day, and they cut that in there. And I'm really glad Simon said that, right? Because he's basically saying, like, America is the best at cultural appropriation. But there can be good cultural appropriation. And it turned into this debate that I've had with myself, okay, if some white kid from, let's say, Buffalo, New York, wanted to make kimchi, at what point, if I myself want to celebrate diversity, inclusion, want people to, like, increase the culinary conscience, what level, what's my threshold for someone that makes kimchi, and when would I find that acceptable? It would be like, okay, they actually, like, make really good kimchi, they're pushing the culinary arts, and they're doing things before that no one's ever been done. And it has nothing to do with skin color, right? It was just like, that would be where I could accept someone making kimchi. And I've been wrestling with this for so long. And it's interesting to see that where I'm like, oh, my original viewpoint was short-sighted because my default reaction is still going to be like, hey, I don't want to like this. I don't want this person to like kimchi. But I'm wrestling with myself because the reaction that I should be doing is to encourage them to make kimchi. And it's the totality of their, like, culinary career that I can hope that they will get to this point where they become like a kimchi master. The worst thing I can do is by telling this kid, like, screw off, you can't make kimchi. And I don't know if that, again, makes sense, but that's, like, shifting how I think about food, where we can put a dish on and that might create conversation. Someone might be upset about it, but I'm like, wait till you see where it goes. This is a process, and I'm not sure exactly where the end goal is, but now we're talking about it, right? Recently, I spoke to a Vietnamese guest and said, I don't like the fact that you're using fish sauce in this dish. I'm like, I'm not, you know? Like, I'm not using fish sauce. You think that I'm using fish sauce, but I'm not. I'm using salted shrimp. And she was very upset that I was, like, bastardizing her cuisine. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not even using fish sauce. She was looking at me as, like, the kid from Buffalo making kimchi. And I'm just like, no. I really want to pay respect, but I want to do it in a different way.
I guess I'll just come out and ask it. You dealt with this in a recent episode of your own podcast. How do you deal with criticism? How do you, like, especially when you obviously put so much thought mm-hmm. and attention into what you're doing, there's a lot of intentionality to it. And when people like, whether it's a customer or a food critic, like or don't like it, what do you do? How does that make you feel?
I'm still learning how to take criticism. I want everyone to have a great time. When anyone feels they got ripped off, that guts me. I feel really good about what we've done, though, at Major Domo. There are times where, like, it just doesn't come together. There's a difference, though, when you are giving your best work and you know it, and when it still falls short to someone's opinion, that's tough. Criticism now is difficult because you're getting it from all sides, from bloggers to Yelpers to chat rooms to, you know, Major Domo has been reviewed by national critics from GQ to Eater to The New Yorker, few others, and LA Times' own Jonathan Gold. And that was tough. And I have a lot to say about that, particularly with Gold, but I'm going to try not to talk about it. I want to give it some time. I feel like I have a lot of things to say about it. But in that podcast with Ryan and Karina, they said something. It's like, if you talk about criticism and you try to attack the critic, you're never going to win. And I want to talk about it, but I think the best thing I can do is to save that energy and to put it back into the restaurant, which I believe is a fantastic restaurant. We have a great team. And the one thing, Jonathan can be mad at me. Hopefully we can talk about that offline one day. But I just felt that the team itself didn't get the credit. The service, the wine program. And listen, it's still criticism. And as great as Jonathan is, and he's literally the best, it's still subjective. And there obviously was a lot in there. I'm sure that review could have been 5,000 words and still not be enough. But when I get criticized from people that I admire, I think it really hurts. And the thing is, if you read that review from Jonathan, we've gotten 2 bad reviews in my career from major publications. And the thing is, I don't even think the Gold review is a bad review. He's trolling me a little bit in terms of how I like to think about embracing a paradox. And I think the review itself is a paradox because every good thing is coupled with the negative thing. And I think Gold is clever enough to write something like that, and maybe one day we'll do an anecdotal thing. I'd love to talk to him about it, but it's interesting that a lot of people read that, and it gives them ambiguity bothers people. And that restaurant review from Jonathan is like nothing I've ever read before. So as a pure fan of restaurant criticism, it's juicy as hell. And it's never fun to be part of that analysis. And this ongoing conversation, like we're talking about it now, I'm sure we're going to be talking about this review forever. But the best thing I can do is make this restaurant and the team there an institution to make sure that we celebrate Los Angeles, we produce new talent that goes on to create their own restaurants, and we make Jonathan Gold eat his own words.
And now there's already here in Los Angeles, there's another highly lauded new opening, a new restaurant from Adam Perry Lang, who's featured in the show. Is it difficult for you as a restaurateur? What do you do when you're the new exciting kid on the block, and now there's already another newer kid on the block? Is it hard for you to stay focused on what you're doing, to sort of whether you're worried about the attention that you're getting and things like that? Are you worried when there's a new restaurant?
No. That's rising tide lifts all boats, and I really believe that. And recently, I got mad at myself because we did this Vicey thing for Netflix. And someone asked me a question hey, how do you get a reservation at your restaurant? It's so hard. And I gave the dumbest response. I'm you take walk-ins or whatever. It was so stupid. What I should have said in retrospect was, hey, Adam Perry Lang's restaurant's opening up. Freeman's, which I haven't been to yet, just got reviewed today by Gold. Glowing review. You want to celebrate the good. And it should not just be focused on what I'm doing. And that's great. I'm really close with Adam Perry Lang. His restaurant is great. It's still in its infancy. So if anything, I don't want people to go in there being this restaurant better be good or else. I want to give him his time to it's still sort of preseason. And I know critics probably say, if you are accepting money, then it's fair game. I think that we need to work on that a little bit as a whole. But LA's got amazing restaurants. Ludo just opened up his new thing in Sherman Oaks. There are great places all over. So I personally want every restaurant that's great to be as busy as humanly possible.
And now I had dinner at Major Domo, and I don't know if I've ever been to a restaurant before where you played whole albums.
Yeah.
And is that your idea? Well, that seems like, on the one hand, that's a small detail, but I'm assuming that's the kind of thing that makes a restaurant, or that you, in some ways, as a person who owns restaurants, you probably obsess over that stuff.
I do.
And so an idea like that, what does that mean in the bigger picture?
I think it was a new trajectory. I'm glad you picked that up without sounding, you can sound like a real jerk talking about stuff like this, but I think it was an internal conversation to the staff that hey, you might have a shuffle at other restaurants you've worked at, but this is going to be something else. This is going to set the tone, and we're not going to play all the music that you think you might want to hear. And the only rule that we had is we're going to edit at most one song on an album. I mean, you name it. Some of the best albums in the world have that one song. And you're I don't know if I want that as a, albums that sound good on a record player are very different when you play it in a restaurant. So that was an intentional thing in certain albums that we wanted to play. I do believe there's probably 6 hours of an actual mix. But if you really listen to that, there's a lot of thought that went into it, because each song leads into, for some reason, a tasting menu into another song. But I wanted to play whole albums because I just want to see how that played out. And it's interesting. We get a lot of criticism for it. Not a lot, but I read it. They're playing the same band again. I love we play Transformer, Lou Reed, and someone's it's another Lou Reed song. And you can hear that and you're I'm okay with that. Younger people have never heard a lot of their earlier Talking Heads albums from start to finish, and they're fantastic. So we'll see. But in some weird way, the music is to set the tone, not for the guest per se, but for the restaurant.
David Chang, thank you very much for being here today. For LA Times Studios and The Real, I'm Mark Olson.
Thank you so much for having me.